Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Mr. Ron Chatman, a person who needs no introduction in the world of white-collar healthcare litigation and opioid litigation. He is the chair of the Chatman Law Group, and he is actively involved in the Supreme Court case that was recently heard, Ruan v. United States, among other cases that are pending review by the Supreme Court. And with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. Chatman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for all that you have done so far and really helping to advocate for patients and physicians who have been disenfranchised in the opioid epidemic. March 1st was no small day in that, and that was the day the case Ruan v. United States was heard, or at least the oral arguments were heard. And for many, that came as a watershed moment. But before we kind of delve into the case and all that it entails, just tell us a little bit about that whole experience of just hearing the oral arguments and just being, I know you couldn't be in the courtroom itself, but kind of just being part of that whole atmosphere.
Yeah, it was a very interesting experience. It's hard as a defense attorney with a lot to say to sit on my hands. And my turn's not up yet. Naum is still being held by the court, as you know. And they'll either summarily reverse or grant or do some mix of the two. We're not quite sure yet. But at least, Ruan was able to go. And I think Larry Robbins, did an effective job. But while we were there listening to him, we were able to take in the entire experience. So just to set the scene, I was there with a number of stakeholders in the opiate community. Dr. Steve Pasek, who is very, very well known in the opiate community, or at least the physician community and prescribing community. Dr. Lynn Webster was also there, who spent many years advocating on behalf of pain patients and was also a pain doctor. And then Kelly Deneen, who's a professor, was also there. And so we had the ability to take in the oral arguments together and talk amongst ourselves about what these questions meant and about the impact of the court's questions on the potential for the decision coming out. And I don't want to jump too far into the argument yet, but I will say that as we were sitting there listening, we just got the general sense that the court and possibly the litigants didn't understand the impact of the questions they were asking and the potential decision that they might make, specifically related to the intent component of 841.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting statement. And in your post on contrafed.com, which shameless plug, I recommend everybody to take a look. You discussed this in detail, and I think it's a critical component to delve into because we always seem to have this arrow missing the target when it comes to good faith, criminal intent, or mens rea, to use the legal terms. Before we jump into why it was missed during the oral arguments, I want to get your sense of why is it always missed in general when we're dealing with healthcare behavior?
Yeah, it's the, in this case, and in many cases, it's the way that the case gets to the court, right? So there are a couple of cases that have sought cert on the 841 issue on opiate prescribing, and the court only took this good faith case. Now, I personally believe, and there's a few out there that support me, that the good faith issue is the wrong issue to even be talking about in the first place, right? Because good faith is not in the text of the statute, as the court pointed out during oral argument, and it's really found nowhere. I think Justice Alito and maybe even Justice Roberts said that as well. The good faith argument only comes into play if you resolve the first issue, and that is what intent is required of a physician in order to be convicted of violating the Controlled Substances Act. The government seems to think that there's no intent component in the statute, which is so strange because there's a case called Morissette out there, which says if there's no intent component, then you need to infer one. And the one that we would usually infer is the intent component listed in the statute. So this case has an intent, this statute has an intent component of knowingly and intelligently. So you can only violate 841 if you do so knowingly and intelligently. The government says, and this is where the grammar argument came into play when you listen to the arguments. The government says that knowingly and intelligently doesn't apply to a doctor scenario. It only applies to a drug dealer scenario. So the way the statute is written and the way the English teachers would read the statute is that knowingly and intelligently only applies to the general public who is distributing drugs. If you knowingly and intelligently distribute a drug and you're not a doctor, you can be convicted. There's this other part of the statute that says except as authorized. And what the government is saying is that there's no intent component related to that except as authorized portion. So that has no intent component. Now, Justice Gorsuch says, well, okay, but according to the video case that he cited and Morissette, we have to read in an intent component. So wouldn't it make sense to read in knowingly and intelligently, which is what the courts have historically done in all 841 prosecution cases? Justice Alito seems to think maybe we don't because Congress didn't say that. Justice Gorsuch said, well, that's only because you're interpreting it in a grammatical way as opposed to a legal way, right?
Right.
So the defense position here is knowingly and intelligently applies to physicians too. It's not some other intent component like strict liability. Mm-hmm. Right? The government seems to be arguing strict liability. And the speed limit example that was used seems to be arguing strict liability. And for your viewers who don't know what strict liability is, that is very similar to a speed limit case.
Right.
If there's a strict liability statute and you engage in the conduct that is prohibited by the statute, you can't go over 50 miles an hour on Woodward Avenue, then you are guilty. You can't say, I didn't know the speed limit. You can't say my car didn't work. You can't say my gas pedal got stuck. You're done. You're convicted. You get your speeding ticket, not really conviction.
Yeah.
So that's strict liability. So the government seems to be arguing that if a doctor deviates from professional norms, they are stripped of the protections, their physician protections, the except as authorized protection, and they get convicted, right? That is such a dangerous position to take, as I'm sure you know, because there's no professional norms.
Yeah.
The CDC got it wrong in 2016, admittedly, right?
Yep.
Every other board and guideline out there has been shifting since the beginning of opiate treatment has ever began. So this idea that there is a speed limit for doctors, Justice Roberts said that. He sort of asked a question related to that. The idea that there is a speed limit for doctors is a ridiculous notion to begin with. And even if there was, these are speed suggestions, not limits, because there's no law saying exactly what a doctor should do when they're prescribing. All right. So going back to Justice Roberts' question, he says, so if you violate the speed limit, are you saying it's okay to say, well, I thought that the speed limit was different? That's the wrong question to ask.
Right.
The question is, if you violate the suggestion of a particular speed limit, can you then argue that I didn't intend to speed because I was following what I thought was the appropriate speed limit? And so that's where the court was going, and that's where the government was trying to pull them. Ultimately, I have my prediction. I wrote about it in ContraFed, and folks can read it there. I think it's the most recent post on the blog. But here's my prediction: Ruan has to get overturned.
Yeah,
great, right? Because the intent component wasn't properly understood or stated in the jury instructions, and he needs to get a new trial under proper instructions, whatever the court sets out. But with all due respect to Dr. Ruan, in fact, I think it's pronounced Ren. I heard Larry Robbins pronounce it that way, so I'll try to do the proper pronunciation. But with all due respect to Dr. Ren, that doesn't help the rest of us. That doesn't help the rest of my clients, the rest of the physicians out there facing scrutiny. Ruan getting overturned and then being tried under a more stringent standard is really, really problematic, and so we don't want that to happen. Thankfully, I think Justice Kavanaugh thinks that the statute is vague because nobody can seem to make sense of it. Gonzalez versus Oregon, a case in 2005, I believe, also suggested the statute was vague. Justice Scalia disagreed with that. So Kavanaugh thinks it's vague. Gorsuch seems to think there is an intent component. It is knowingly and intentionally. And I think he believes that the good faith question is a good question to ask and a good shorthand way to describe a physician's knowing and intentional conduct. I believe also Justice Thomas will side with him. And I think there's a possibility that Roberts will as well. Justice Barrett, open question. It seems that she may not be squarely in our favor, but I think we have the votes for potentially a better standard to be delivered under Ruan. But Ruan gets reversed, and then it's an open question as to exactly what standard the court will lay down. There's two options for the court, really. Number one, they read the statute essentially as strict liability. If a physician doesn't prescribe within their authorization to prescribe controlled substances for a legitimate medical purpose in the course of professional practice, if they don't do that, then bam, they're guilty, right?
Right.
There's no good faith. There's no knowingly, intelligently, just boom, you've passed the speed limit. You're going to go to jail, all right? This is a speed limit with potentially 20-year mandatory minimums attached, right?
Yeah.
So that's option one, almost a strict liability. In fact, it actually would be a strict liability question. Option two is to say that knowingly and intelligently applies. And if knowingly and intelligently is the intent component, then a doctor can say, I prescribed in good faith, and therefore I was not knowingly and intelligently distributing drugs. That's what the defense was asking for. But there's this other issue, and that is one of federalism. That wasn't addressed by the court, that I hope will get to be addressed by Naum versus United States. And that is really the authorization of the DEA to regulate the practice of medicine through this strict liability application of professional norms. This is the troubling thing. The federal government is not the state medical board.
Yeah.
They don't get the right to police the practice of medicine. And to say there is a standard out there, and if a physician violates just that standard, engaging in malpractice, that they can be convicted, you've basically made the federal government, the DEA, a de facto medical board that instead of revoking, restricting, disciplining, or some other punishment on a license, they can just start dishing out 20-year sentences to physicians.
Yeah,
that's very troubling. I hope the court is mindful of that fact and the dangerous possibilities that rest within a strict liability.
Yeah.
Answer.
You used the phrase strict liability, and I think that's important because that was discussed heavily. Another component, or at least a frame of understanding, was an objective and a subjective standard. Is it fair to say that strict liability is more along the lines of an objective standard, or those are two separate terms that should be understood distinctly?
I think that the defense is pigeonholing the government by saying, or the petitioners are pigeonholing the government by saying that if you make it a purely subjective standard, I'm sorry, purely objective standard, that it's akin to strict liability. And here's how that argument plays out. So 841, the drug trafficking statute, says that except as authorized, you can't deal with drugs. Mm-hmm. If the court interprets the intent component as not being knowingly and willfully related to the except as authorized, then they will be saying if you violate a professional norm, you can be convicted. The next question is whether or not it is appropriate to subjectively believe that you are engaging in proper conduct, or if the requirement is that you objectively engaged in proper conduct. If the question is an objectively engaged in proper practice of medicine question, that means that the statute is one of strict liability. And so even if there's an intent component, that intent component doesn't work anymore, because as soon as you violate a professional norm. Now, the government didn't stand up and say that the objective component requires a strict liability application of the statute. What they said is a physician needs to take an honest effort to comply. And so I actually believe that the government in this case was arguing for a subjective component, but then calling it an objective one, which was so strange to me.
Right.
In fact, Larry Robbins, Wren's counsel, at the end said this is a malpractice standard gussied up as an objective component. But the government used the words honest effort to comply when they were arguing what the standard should be. What they're saying is if a doctor makes an honest effort to comply with an objective requirement, then they can't be convicted. And I think the honest effort includes a subjective state of mind, right?
Yeah.
Only you know the honesty of your effort, the sincerity of your effort. And so that's the confusing part of the government's argument. And that's what Gorsuch was calling them out on at the end. I think he was saying, you really don't even know what you're asking this court for, because you're not even being clear about whether it's subjective. They didn't want to take the objective position, because to do so would have made it look like they were arguing for strict liability and they would have lost. Okay. So what they did was they tried to water down their objective requirement by adding this good faith subjective requirement in there. And that's where we completely lose their position. We don't understand where it is. Defense or petitioner's position was relatively strong. Many statutes out there deal with the good faith of the defendant, and that's the way that we describe the intent required to convict. And in this case, it seems to make sense, because as Justice Potter Stewart said in Moore many, many years ago, it's very problematic to start limiting the practice of medicine to only those things that the practice of medicine says is appropriate, right?
Right.
Doctors should be able to explore. They should be able to treat medicine as an art sometimes. They should be able to try new things. Good example, I've seen a lot of research that says that opiates are not appropriate for fibromyalgia. And I've even had expert witnesses in court say that opiates are not appropriate for fibromyalgia. Some people believe it. I also know some very intelligent people who believe that opiates are appropriate for fibromyalgia in certain circumstances. Well, if the government says that opiates are not appropriate for fibromyalgia and that's considered an objective standard, you go to jail for doing something that other people believe is appropriate, even if it's not sort of squarely written down in a standard. And that becomes very problematic. So the medical advances in the fields of pain management will just absolutely halt and crumble.
So it's interesting how you gave that example, because inherent is the medical context underlying the decision. I didn't hear much of that in the arguments made or the commentary by the justices. Why does the clinical context often fall to the wayside?
Well, it's because they can't get into it. They're not supposed to, because federalism says that they can't. This court should not sit and ask themselves questions of malpractice. What is appropriate? So they have to sidestep that issue, and they have to defer to others. There was some discussion about whether or not the standard is a fact standard or a legal standard. Justice Roberts seemed to think that legitimate medical purpose is a legal standard, while the petitioners stated very clearly that it was a factual standard. And that's the rub. The court would love to have a legal standard that sort of defines the conduct, because then the statute can be upheld.
Yeah.
But I think what we've been saying all along is the statute is vague because it defers to a vague standard. What is legitimate medical purpose?
Yeah.
Is that up to physicians? Is it up to state boards? Is it up to the jury? We don't know. And that's the problem in all of these cases.
It's almost as though we're now moving into this world of alphabet soup, where today it's good faith, tomorrow might be bona fide medical practice. It almost seems that we're just creating these philosophical arguments that are circular and just trying to find phrases absent clinical context.
When you scratch away at any federal statute or regulation, you usually get to a point where it ends in a term of art. And that term of art is not very clearly defined, and that's where the judges do their work. And that's where the juries do their work. A jury has to sit and determine what is legitimate medical purpose. And I'm okay with that, because I've been able to convince a lot of juries that a lot of different prescribing practices are legitimate medical purposes, thankfully. And I'm okay with that resting with the jury. And that's why these terms of art or these circular reasonings are there. What we can't have is strict liability application, because if a jury gets an instruction that a physician's conduct must comport with the legitimate medical purpose, and a court defines legitimate medical purpose as adhering to a standard, then every time a physician deviates from the CDC guidelines or a state board regulation, they will get slapped with a criminal offense, as I said before. And that's very dangerous, because there's no demarcation between which types of violations are worse and which types of violations are acceptable. You know, an example I gave when I was talking to some folks about this case the other day is, let's say there's a medical regulation that says physicians must have a hand washing sign in their bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And at this clinic, they prescribe opiates and they don't have a hand washing sign in the bathroom. Could they be convicted for unlawfully prescribing opiates because their facility didn't meet the requirements of a federal regulation?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but that's essentially what they're saying, right? I mean, if you need to sign your charts and you forget to sign a chart, does that mean that your prescriptions were unlawful? You could start getting closer and closer to the practice of medicine. That hand washing example is all the way out here. But where do we draw the line when we start getting closer and closer? And that's troubling.
Well, what's interesting is that I think the government kind of admitted as much. And like you talked about how they're creating these watered down arguments. Was it almost as if the government is simply arguing to take a stand for its past actions, knowing a change has to occur? Or you still believe that there may be a certain level of resistance on the part of the government, Department of Justice, DEA, to kind of fight for this absence of federalism, this almost kind of unprecedented encroachment into where a deviation is a crime?
Well, I saw Mr. Fagan's arguments as either short-sighted or just plain evil, to be honest. Either he doesn't know that applying an objective standard here is going to cause hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people to be left in pain. Either he doesn't know that, or he knows it and he's proceeding forward to create one of the largest public health crises in the United States that we'll ever face.
Yeah.
I think they have to make up for their past actions because the government hasn't acted honestly during the opiate epidemic. They've pursued physicians that shouldn't have been pursued. They've taken inconsistent positions. They've almost acted with sort of bloodlust in many of these cases. And so I think he has to make sure that those stand when he stands up. But I don't think he knows the evils that are about to be caused if he's successful in getting a strict liability standard.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about the implications leading to a public health crisis. As we talked about, overdoses, patients left with intractable pain, suicides that occur thereof. Were the CDC guidelines and the revisions and the acknowledgement that the CDC aired when it created these purported fixed standards ever brought up at any point in the oral arguments?
That's a really good question. Actually, I was surprised to see that it wasn't brought up in the oral arguments. It almost seemed like Bo Brindley, and I was biting my lip when he said this, seemed to suggest that there is an objective standard out there. I also think that Larry Robbins also suggested the same. Nobody stood up to the court and said, there is no standard. It's impossible. In fact, I think Brindley said, well, there's state boards and regulations and hinted at the CDC guidelines. But I think that that's a crucial mistake in this litigation, to admit that there are real standards out there for the practice of pain management is not the position that we want to take. Because these standards don't exist, they're confusing. In some cases, they were improperly passed and they don't have the effect of law. Right? Yeah. CDC guidelines don't have the effect of law. It was raised in the amicus briefs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it certainly was raised in large part in the NOUM petition for cert. There was a long section that specifically discussed how dangerous it is to start interpreting course of medical practice as adherence to a standard. Maybe this wasn't argued because they don't think the court would be receptive, but that's not the reason to back away from the truth, right? Yeah. And that's one of my issues with the performance on March 1st.
To kind of just put myself in the minds of those presenting the arguments, would they look at the CDC policy shifts on opioid prescribing and some of the acknowledgments on errors made as clinical context? Or is it sufficiently different from the actual clinical context underlying a decision where it could be permissible in legal arguments around opioid prescribing?
Well, that's tough to say. I think clinical context is certainly important. I think that should be a function of expert testimony. Right. I'm completely fine if an expert takes the stand and says the CDC guidelines are the standard because I'll blow them up, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's enough out there. You've got the AMA who's spoken out against them. You've got the CDC pivoting incredibly hard on their prior MME calculations. You've got studies out here that say MME is actually sort of a ridiculous idea to begin with.
Yeah.
and by MME, I mean morphine milligram equivalents, a way that we usually compare the strength and overdose potential of opiates. So clinical context is vital. I think it's important, but I think that that's a question of fact. I think it needs to be laid out for the jury. I'm okay with the government trying to set the standard, but the standard shouldn't be adherence to an objective or a clinical requirement or guideline. The standard is whether a physician's conduct falls so far below the guidelines, policies, and notions of the practice of medicine that they can't be seen as practicing medicine at all. And that was made eminently clear in the Moore case, the first Supreme Court case on this issue.
Was that case ever referenced in the arguments?
It was quite a bit, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
That's where we get the standards. I just am not sure why the parties here bend it to the interpretation of Moore that it adheres to an objective standard, because that's not what Moore says at all. What Moore says is, certainly we can look to the requirements of the practice of medicine, but that's only to inform us of what medicine looks like. And if this doesn't look like medicine, it's not medicine, and therefore you can be a criminal.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Is it one of those things where when dealing with the issue of pornography, says, I don't know how to describe it, but I know it when I see it. And people are just trying to get away from that subjectiveness, that we have this quest to quantify everything in healthcare. So this is part of that quest.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think that I'm comfortable with that I know it when I see it standard. I know drug dealing when I see it. Was this guy or gal as a physician trying to be a drug dealer? I'm good with that. Creating a strict definition of pornography has all sorts of implications, right?
Yeah.
A couple of pictures that you may have on your phone that you send to somebody that you know considered distribution of pornography now? And we've got people who are sending, you know, fun messages back and forth to each other, convicted of distribution and violating federal rules. I think that has broad implications for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's interesting the parallels you can make when you start to create these standards that are not really reflective of true behavior in the context in which they take. I want to now zoom out, big picture. This was probably the first, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, case that made it to the level of the Supreme Court that involves opioids, in so much as we've now begun the era of the opiate epidemic. Obviously, there's been prominent cases making news, physicians, pharmaceutical manufacturers, but none have reached that level of judicial analysis as the Supreme Court. Is this by design? Is there a deliberate effort by the justices to parse through this issue one by one, or it's simply something they saw, they liked, and so they took it up?
Yeah, I had a theory, and that wasn't well supported by oral argument, but I'm still going to stick to it. I believe that we're here at the Supreme Court because of abortion. The opiate cases haven't been heard historically because it would have caused the court to weigh in on the state's or the federal government's ability to regulate the practice of medicine generally. Mm-hmm. And of course, as you know, in the abortion debate, you have folks who are pro-life saying not that abortion should be banned. You have them saying abortion should be left up to the states to do what they want to do, right? That's their very clear position. You have people who are pro-choice saying Roe v. Wade is the law. There can't be any unreasonable restriction on abortion. Roe v. Wade essentially is a comment on the practice of medicine because abortion is considered a medical procedure. The right. government is saying this medical procedure is authorized, and pro-life folks are saying that is really a states' rights issue. So the position I'm advancing, which doesn't seem to be shared yet by anybody, but I'm okay with that. I think maybe I know more than a lot about where this is going, is that the limited government conservatives on the court, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Barrett, maybe Roberts will go that way. Of course, I don't know that Roberts really wants to go that far on abortion, and that's why his position may be swayed to the left on these cases. But I think at least those three justices want to author an opinion that says that having an objective standard is not something that is allowed under federal law because the federal government cannot occupy the field of medicine and they can't regulate it generally. And because of principles of federalism, we can't adhere to this objective standard of care component. I think that's what they want to say. And interestingly, the questioning did support the theory that those three limited government conservative justices who seem to be poised to potentially overturn Roe versus Wade, that's where they seem to go. They seem to be squarely in support of the petitioners in this case, Dr. Wren and Dr. Kahn. So the posture of the court is shaping up to be exactly what I thought it was. And when we see the decision, if we see it filled with federalist ideas and states' rights ideas, which I think Gorsuch is ready to say, then we will know that it was an attempt at slowly changing the abortion debate.
That's a really interesting parallel between the two. And for those of you who may not kind of see the immediate parallels, the idea is, as Mr. Chapman alluded to, the issue of regulating medicine in general terms. And when we apply general principles like strict liability, objective standards, they permeate at an individual level into hard limits, draconian interpretations of law. And so they want to get away from that for a position they already believe in, limited abortion regulations. And so by using that in the opioid context, they're essentially saying that if we can't do it for procedures, we can't do it for prescriptions either. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
So in that vein, then, should we expect to see more opioid-related cases reach Supreme Court, in a sense, trying to reinstill this belief? Or is it almost like one and done? Once we've kind of established a standard for prescribing practices, now we can move on to other procedures or other cases.
I think that the court's going to work around the periphery. And if other Supreme Court cases pop up that implicate federalist issues and states' rights issues related to the practice of medicine, I think that we will see those conservative justices try to get enough votes to hear those cases. It takes 5 votes to hear a case. When the court sits in conference to grant cert on a case. And if you may recall, Ruan and Naum were held by the court for many, many conferences while they batted around the case. It sounds like there was some disagreement about whether it should be taken. I think the liberal justices who want Roe versus Wade to stand, and I take no position on that at all. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm not going to dive into abortion. But I will just say that the liberal justices who don't want the court to get a shot at making that federalist interpretation are going to try to block cases like Wren and cases like Naum, whereas the conservative justices are trying to get them up to the court. So I think what we should do is continue to look at those cases that implicate that federalism argument and states' rights in the practice of medicine and see if they continue to get the votes to raise these issues. And then when there finally is the right case for them to take a look at abortion, you may see an opinion that is chock full of all of these decisions. The court said in Wren that, you know, states regulate the practice of medicine. That's not a federal government, you know, authorization. And then, you know, the rest of the cases will fall in as well. This is why I think they are really struggling with whether or not to take Naum, because Naum is squarely a federalist case.
Yeah. Interesting. You mentioned that before. And if that case does reach the Supreme Court, you will be arguing that case. For those of you who may not have heard of that case, can you just provide a brief synopsis on what the case is and what you would be arguing for in the cert?
Yep, it's already up at the Supreme Court. It was filed around the same time as Dr. Wren. They granted Wren and Kahn. They have been holding on to Naum, I think because they don't want the decision in Naum to impact those two cases. So now, once they issue the decision in this case, they will turn to Naum and decide what's going to happen. And if they do grant cert on that, I will certainly argue the case, and I'm happy to. But it is a stronger case in the sense that it raises more of these federalist issues, and it's not related to this tangential, you know, good faith issue. The Naum case is one in which a Suboxone prescriber was prosecuted. And this is the most ridiculous position I've ever seen a trial judge take in this field. What this trial judge said is the standard outside the course of professional practice and for other than a legitimate medical purpose, that standard can be severed. And so if a doctor prescribes outside the course of professional practice, she can be guilty. If a doctor prescribed for no legitimate medical purpose, she can be guilty, either or, right? Our interpretation, the DEA's interpretation, and the interpretation of many courts is that that standard is one standard outside the course of professional practice for other than a legitimate medical purpose. And what that means is the doctor intending to practice medicine and alleviate suffering or prescribe a legitimate medication. So this judge severed the standard. And then she said, Dr. Naum, you can't, I was the trial counsel in the case. She said, Mr. Chapman, you cannot introduce evidence of the legitimate medical purpose of the drug because that's not an issue before the court. The only issue is whether or not he complied with the requirements of the practice of medicine, which in the state of West Virginia required a physical examination before prescribing an opiate. Suboxone is an opiate, arguably, right? But it is not one in which a physical examination is even close to necessary.
Yeah.
It's a more of a psychiatric drug. It's used to blockade the effect of withdrawal and prevent a patient from going through debilitating suffering withdrawals. And in fact, in Europe, I believe, and maybe even in Canada, Suboxone can be given out by a pharmacist at a pharmacy without any evaluation whatsoever. So she was just flat wrong. So we go all the way to the Fourth Circuit. Fourth Circuit seems to not want to disrupt prior opinions and just sort of, you know, gives us a flick of the hand. You know, we're going to deny you, go up to the big dogs upstairs, the Supreme Court. So we file a petition for cert. The reason why this can't be handled before Wren is because whether or not that standard can be split up goes directly at the heart of the regulation. Not the collateral issues of intent, right? So they need to decide this first to determine whether or not it's a subjective or an objective requirement. Then they'll look at this case and make a decision.
It's interesting. Is this a common pattern in the Supreme Court where they look at a particular issue that's been litigated over and over and then slowly parse their way through it? Or is it something where the opiate epidemic has kind of spurred this new way of thinking or challenge the existing standards of legal thought?
This is how the court always works, and it's genius. I love how they operate. It's slow. It's not as efficient as we might like, but watching them evolve their decision-making slowly over time as to not disrupt the careful balance of our system is a beautiful thing. And I think it's amazing that our Constitution created this system and the court understands its responsibility to not move in fits and starts and knee-jerk reactions, but to slowly make sure it gets it right, to decide a case a certain way, see how it's handled by society, tweak that logic later. Dred Scott, right? Slavery. Yeah. Brown versus Board. The first time the court had this issue, if they decided it in a way that was just immediately apparent to them, they may have changed the landscape of history. When they decided Brown versus Board, they didn't make a requirement to desegregate immediately. They actually required these sort of plans to be created so that the public could then sort of grapple with this decision. Imagine if they went so far in Brown versus Board and said, segregated schools is just completely inappropriate. You must desegregate now. You would have had people not understand this decision and then split historically black schools in half and send half of those patients or half of those students to historically white schools. And we would have had just turmoil, riots. We would have had, kids not wanting to go to that school because they were just sort of thrown out of one into the other. It wouldn't have been good for society. So when we zoom out, as you said before, and we look at these cases with the benefit of history and respect towards the future, we see that the court really should move slowly. This is not about Dr. Naum or Dr. Wren or Dr. Khan anymore.
Yeah.
This is about the future of our country and state of medicine. As much as we want them to get a fair trial and have the right thing happen to them, and I deeply care about that, we can't do that at the expense of history and the future, right?
Yeah, that's well said. I want to leave you with two broad questions, and I acknowledge in advance that they're a little unfair So I want to just kind of put that out there. So don't be afraid to kind of hedge in the response. But you talk about in your blog, you can't really predict an outcome because that's like predicting the weather 30 days in advance. But based on your unique insights, and you know, your insight is quite revealing in many ways because you're so ingrained into this field. Based on the arguments that you see, there is a likely outcome that'll happen. Talk to us about what you think the likely outcome will be, but also kind of now the implications moving forward, the what next, if you will.
Yeah, I think that this is not the opiate case. I think this is one of a few that will be handled by the court as they continue to decide this over the next 10 years and maybe right the ship and eventually get this right. So that's my first prediction. I think they do have to deal with the intent component. Mm-hmm. I do believe that the Supreme Court will say that knowingly and willfully violating the requirements of your registration is required, and therefore a good faith instruction would be appropriate. I do believe that they will reverse the 11th Circuit in Dr. Wren's case. And then I believe, is it the, maybe the 9th in Dr. Kahn's case, I can't recall. That will be settled. I don't believe that they will go so far as to make this federalist argument. Mm. I don't think the court wants to dive that deeply in. I do expect a new trial for both of those physicians. And given that I represent Dr. Couch, a co-defendant, I will be there in the courtroom, you know, arguing my ass off on behalf of them and trying to make sure that the shot that they got, the moon shot that they got at the Supreme Court, is actually driven all the way home at the trial court level.
Yeah, no. And all the best to you, Mr. Chapman. You have been an amazing force for so many patients and physicians affected. And we cannot thank you enough for everything that you're doing. And so with that being said, please stay safe, safe travels, and continue the good fight.
Thank you, sir. It was great talking to you. I appreciate it, Jay.